This free program is paid for by the listeners of Redwood Community Radio. If you're not already a member, please think of joining us. Thank you.
Welcome to this month's Ask Your Herb Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.
For those of you who perhaps have never listened to our shows, they run every third Friday of the month from 7 till 8 p.m. And we're both licensed medical herbalists who trained in England, graduating there with a degree in herbal medicine. We run a clinic in Garberville where we consult with clients about a wide range of conditions. And we manufacture all our own certified organic herb extracts, which are either grown on our CCOF certified herb farm or which we source from other USA certified organic suppliers. So you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM, and from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's topic of weight gain. The number here, if you live in the area, is 923-3911, or if you live outside the area, the toll-free number is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. We can also be reached toll-free on 1-888-WBM-HERB for further questions during normal business hours, Monday through Friday. Once again, we're very welcome to have Dr. Raymond Peat to share his expertise on the subject tonight. Again, one of those subjects related to something that he has a lot of experience with through his research into thyroid and progesterone, other related compounds that are essential, if you like, for healthy metabolism and for anti-stress, anti-aging effects. So thanks so much for joining us again this month, Dr. Peat.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think as usual, we want to give the benefit to those listeners perhaps who haven't heard of you or haven't tuned into this show before, the benefit of your past experience. So if you wouldn't mind just detailing your academic professional career to those people.
After I had taught linguistics and English and such for a while, I decided to go to graduate school in biology at University of Oregon, and graduated there with my PhD in 1972 with specializing in physiology and biochemistry, especially reproductive physiology. And right after I left university, I worked for a while with a diet company counseling people in weight loss.
Okay, excellent.
So that was 41 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, well, hopefully we're going to cover quite a lot of material here tonight, because I know that the subject surrounding tonight's topic of weight gain or how to avoid it and what causes it, etc., etc., will be pretty pertinent to a lot of people, even if they're not overtly overweight. So I think one of the main things just to let people know about, apart from anything else, is that you do actually have a pretty active Facebook fan page, Dr. Peat, whether you know it or not, I don't know, but it's an active Ray Peat Facebook fan page. For those of you who are familiar with Facebook and use it, that's something perhaps you might want to look at. There's a pretty lively debate and forum surrounding most of those topics that we've covered with Dr. Peat over the last few years. So I think one of those things that has come out of the forum, and I know it's something that we've noticed ourselves, but that's not to say that it's unavoidable, because it certainly is, and that's going to be the discussion of tonight's show. I think one of those things that people are asking each other on the Facebook page is how people can adopt your diet and not expect any weight gain. I know the thing that most people have talked about is some extra weight around the abdomen in relation to your specifications for diet. So, Sarah, what were you going to say?
Well, I just think that, you know, that's quite a broad statement there.
It is very broad.
And basically, you can't say that when people adopt Dr. Peat's diet, because, you know, if you know, we say milk is good for you, and you go and you start drinking a half a gallon of whole milk a day, you know, you're going to put on weight unless you basically cut out all other calories. So,
right. Well, that's what
you know,
that's
this
what
is
we're
where
it,
I think
into.
People get confused. Like, well, how much milk should I drink? And should I, if I don't want to gain weight, should I drink whole milk or low fat or, you know?
Right.
And it's the same with cheese, too. I advise eating cheese because of its high calcium and protein content, but you have to consider the calories because some cheese has practically no fat. Others are basically like soft butter for their fat content.
Like brie or chèvre.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. P, I guess what I wanted to start off with first then was asking you this. One of the main components to weight management then is a functional energy reserve coupled with a healthy metabolism, and this is your expertise. So would you outline perhaps what constitutes a healthy metabolism in terms of what we know as glucose oxidation versus the opposite, the fatty acid metabolism that occurs with stress, so our listeners can tell the difference?
And before you answer that, Dr. Pete, just to say that you've told us before that if somebody has an unhealthy metabolism, they'll have a hard time burning 1,000 calories a day.
Yeah, there was a study about 30 or 40 years ago in which doctors used to follow the textbook standard that everyone can lose weight if they eat less than 1,700 calories a day, because that was a study done in the 20s or 30s on healthy people. And so they put a group of women who claimed that they were gaining weight on 1,000 calories, put them in a closed ward and actually counted how much food they were eating. And some of them could maintain their weight on 700 calories a day, especially women who had dieted a lot, because several adaptations happened to chronic poorly balanced dieting. The thyroid slows down, and especially the muscle tissues atrophy from the stress of dieting. And if you think of the stress metabolism as being very similar to the diabetic metabolism, basically you shift over to burning fat rather than sugar. At rest, your brain and red blood cells need sugar, and they'll keep burning it regardless of where they have to get it. If you don't eat enough of the necessary nutrients, your body will convert your muscles to sugar to keep feeding your brain what it needs. And if you are eating enough sugar or things which can be turned into sugar, then your body doesn't have to break down its own tissues to make the necessary glucose for your blood cells and brain. And in that condition, your muscles at rest don't require practically any glucose. They can do fine on a pure fat diet, but that's the resting muscle. If your muscles are under stress, very intense exercise, the muscles will begin burning almost pure sugar. So it's the massive muscle at rest which will burn fat calories and leave the protein for your functioning tissues and the sugar to sustain your essential brain and immune system and such.
So this is why you're an advocate of muscle building, because then it helps convert your fat into, well, it helps your body to burn the fat for fuel rather than just using the sugar.
Yeah, and when the muscle is stressed, it begins actually producing estrogen. When you're building muscle in a safe way, the muscle begins producing testosterone actually right in the muscle, which helps the rest of the body. The heart is one of the main targets of testosterone. Well-developed skeletal muscles are actually sustaining the heart muscle as well as the brain and the lungs, which need the stabilizing anti-inflammatory steroids.
So is this why they find that when there's muscly people that they have longer lifespans? One of the reasons, do you think?
Well, Yeah, everything that tends to kill you shrinks your muscles. Frailty is the basic thing that associates with aging. Bones and muscles go away at about the same rate with aging.
Okay, so getting back to what you've started to outline under what would be regular metabolism for the body to burn glucose preferentially rather than liberating free fatty acids to produce energy. The diet starvation type model would then force your body into utilizing stored fats for energy. Is that correct?
Except when it does that, it also needs to make some sugar for your brain. And right. So it breaks down the tissues. The first to go is your thymus, which in just a few hours, they used to think that adults didn't have a significant amount of thymus tissue because they looked at people who had died after being sick. And even if you die slowly after a traumatic accident, your thymus is gone. It just takes a few hours of intense stress for the thymus to be dissolved. And so a long fast will just completely devastate your thymus tissues. It turns into sugar very quickly.
And that's important for your immune system, right?
Yeah. Right. And the skin is relatively dispensable, too, in the long run. So your skin atrophies very quickly with a fast or even a low-calorie diet. And then the muscles go. You can live months on your muscles, providing sugar for your brain if necessary, if you have big muscles. But
right.
Lots of the women that I used to see who were there for a weight loss diet, you couldn't find a bicep muscle or a calf muscle. They couldn't. They would try to tighten their muscle and they couldn't feel or find anything either in their upper arm or lower leg.
Okay.
The muscle was maybe the size of a person's index finger.
Wow.
And so when they would first start eating a good diet, the first thing that would happen would be pounds of water loss. Their tissue would suddenly come out of the stress condition and get rid of some of the stored water. Then the muscle would start growing. The first week they might lose 10 or 15 pounds of water.
Okay.
But then for about a month they would start putting on weight as their muscles began growing.
Okay, because obviously muscle is denser than fat, right? And so a slender person with a well-defined muscular structure would weigh more than a larger person that seemed large through fat.
Yeah, we would have people measure their waists and thighs and hips.
Okay.
And each week they would get smaller as they gained weight.
Uh-huh. Okay, as they started leaning and toning up, they shrunk in volume, but they increased in mass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, so what about athletes and, you know, like long-distance runners, people that are very thin and lean? How healthy would you say their metabolism is?
There was a study of using radioactive testosterone, and they not only saw that the runner's muscles were atrophied, but comparing them to weightlifters who had developed huge skeletal muscles, with these isotopes they could make a picture of their heart, lungs, and brain and so on. All of their tissues had atrophied, so that the lean long-distance runners also had lean, flabby hearts, very thin hearts.
And here that's supposed to be a heart-healthy form of exercise.
Yeah, stereotypical picture of health, that kind of Kenyan long-distance marathon runner.
A lot of things happen. Fertility is often reduced because the testosterone goes down, and the very immediate thing that you can see in even fairly low-intensity exercise is that the lungs lose some of their ability to diffuse oxygen in and carbon dioxide out.
Huh.
The actual substance of the lung air sac thickens with just a fairly moderate amount of continued exercise.
Is that an inflammatory process that's causing that, or?
Yeah, it's a kind of edema, mild inflammation, and sports anemia is a recognized thing. It's a combination of all of those little stresses and shift away from the anabolic testosterone to the females are always relatively anemic because of the influence of the balance of estrogen relative to the androgens. Hmm. And sports anemia is somewhat like the feminizing effect of estrogen on the blood system.
So the long-distance runner has an deformed heart and deformed lungs, basically, compared to the bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hold it there for a second. You're listening to Ask Europe Doctor on KMUD Garverville 91.1 FM. And from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject of weight loss. Our guest speaker here is Dr. Raymond Pete. And from 7:30 till 8, we'll be open for questions. But Dr. Pete, moving on a little bit then in a tangent direction, are some people more predisposed to this kind of inefficient glucose oxidation from other causes, like I know you mentioned PUFA a lot, or cortisol dominant type pictures?
Yeah, lots of things can interfere with your high rate of metabolism. Things that suppress your thyroid are the basic most common thing, but anything that can increase your cortisol or even your glucagon can interfere with your metabolism, slow down your metabolic rate. Serotonin, estrogen, for example, both lower your body temperature.
Okay.
And many stresses can increase those, and those tend to increase the glucagon, shift you away from being able to oxidize the glucose and instead depend on fatty acid oxidation.
Okay. So sluggish digestion could increase estrogen and estrogen and serotonin, and radiation could increase estrogen and serotonin.
Yeah, the bowel is one of the ways to get rid of unneeded estrogen by way of the liver excreting it. And if your bowel is sluggish, you reabsorb it. And if your bowel is irritated and sluggish, it secretes much more serotonin than needed, which affects your whole hormonal system, bringing up the stress hormones and contributing to lowered temperature.
So eating carrots with vinegar or lemon juice or just carrots and taking liver herbs like cascara and dandelion root, milk thistle can help with sluggish bowels.
Yeah, and just eating what you consider to be the most delicious food can greatly help the intestine secrete more juices so things digest faster and move along more smoothly.
So enjoy your food. Hopefully we can enjoy our food, and hopefully it's not enjoying PUFAs, which is fried whatever. As long as it's not fried in coconut oil, then it's bad for you.
Okay, so let's get back to where we were at the beginning in terms of people mentioning that they can't help but gain a bit of extra mid weight, and I think what we're coming around to is that exercise and muscle building, however small or however gentle, however gradual, is one of the most important things when adopting a typical diet that would certainly replace all the nutrition that a person needs. I know your diet does that. So in terms of gentle muscle building, how do you advocate that to happen, say, in a sedentary 60-year-old lady, perhaps?
Just doing an occasional knee bend, squatting and standing up again, and maybe getting some 5-pound dumbbells. Mm-hmm. And lifting those in different motions, just a few lifts, two or three times a day, and when you're doing that, maybe squat once or twice.
Right, because it really is about being actively involved in generating muscle, however gently or however lightly the weight or the exercise would involve. Okay, because you're saying essentially that muscle in its own right effectively burns glucose, and the very presence of muscle with the increase in testosterone will actually improve the metabolic rate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Now another direction. Then you've mentioned in I don't know, you mentioned this earlier on that you said. And this is for the guys, I think, preferentially, because they probably have more of a chance to see this. But you mentioned foaming urine as being an indicator of an excess excretion of steroid hormone precursors and being a sign of stress.
Well, in the morning, you have generally been exposed to several hours of darkness, and darkness is very stressful. Just staying indoors too much gives you chronic stress from the absence of light, but everyone in the morning is at their peak of being exposed to stress hormones from the darkness. And during stress, like starvation, the hormones first try to mobilize energy production, and that during the night involves increased free fatty acids, sort of like doing a little marathon during the night as far as the shift to fatty acids goes. And your liver, if it's well nourished and supplied with thyroid hormones, will process steroids such as estrogen and cortisol, which reach it. The liver will attach either a sulfate or a sugar, glucuronic acid, to make it water-soluble so that then it can leave in the bloodstream to the kidneys and be excreted. Mm-hmm. And in that, attached to the either the sulfate or the sugar, it is like a soap. It's oily at one end and water-soluble at the other, and so it makes foam.
Okay.
And during the night, the fatty acids can be processed in the same way. And the liver especially recognizes the unsaturated fatty acids, but whatever arrives during the night is likely to contribute to that morning foam.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I know you mentioned the liver's ability in storing glucose for the nighttime diet, fast, if you like, for the 8 hours that we don't eat. So given that a person's consuming adequate sugars during the daytime to stock their liver for the nighttime fast, or given that the person would, as we recommend, and I know that you've been an advocate and suggestion of this, that they're eating a small amount of ice cream at night time before bed, or they're taking a glass of orange juice to bed with them to sip on whenever they wake up to get a little bit of sugar so that their adrenaline is kept down and their nighttime stress response doesn't occur. Do you think is that still possible for somebody to have foaming morning urine in the presence of sugars during the nighttime?
Stress always occurs, but if you're sleeping soundly and deeply, there's less intense damage from the stress.
Hmm.
So if you stayed awake in the dark, you would probably have a super foamy urine in the morning.
Okay. And this is something else, perhaps during the daytime, if some of the guys notice what's happening with them during the day. This, again, would be another indicator of insufficient sugars to block adrenaline and other stress hormones, and that their system was reasonably stressed.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay.
And what about for females?
Same thing.
Yeah. It's just not as obvious.
It's not as obvious. I'm only saying it because of how obvious it is. Okay, so, going on to the shift the shift in fat content or fat makeup that you advocate from or the recommendations that our listeners have heard over the last few years in terms of increased saturated fats, switching to butter, coconut, palm oil, excluding all the liquid oils as sources of PUFA. excuse me. I know you've mentioned in the past that the need to avoid PUFA is pretty paramount if you really want to make a change in your physiology. But I think you've also said that it's very difficult to avoid it totally because you're naturally going to produce some.
The natural foods, milk, beef, lamb, coconut oil, and so on, these all have 2 or 3% unsaturated polyunsaturated fats. And if you eat just a tiny bit more than you're going to burn right away, some of it gets stored in your fat tissue. And what is stored is preferentially polyunsaturated fats. Your body recognizes that the good stuff to burn right away is the saturated fat right after the sugars. And so it selectively doesn't burn the polyunsaturated fat quickly, and so it's the most likely to be stored. But then your fat is the same way. Fat cells prefer to burn saturated fat. And so whatever you've stored in your fat by eating more than you needed, over time, your fat cells use up the percentage of the stored saturated fat and increase the percentage of the stored polyunsaturated fat, so that as you get older and fatter, or even if you don't get fatter, as you get older, your fat tissue becomes more polyunsaturated, so that each time you get hungry or stressed and draw on your fat stores for energy, it is more anti-thyroid and more pro-estrogenic because of its increasing polyunsaturation with time.
So with a common recommendation of, this is a common recommendation I make, is include 3 tablespoons of coconut oil in your diet a day. But, of course, if we're talking about someone who only burns 700 calories a day, would you still make that same recommendation to do 3 tablespoons of coconut oil?
More like a small teaspoon 3 times a day.
Right. So I think basically what we, our listeners and we have to keep in mind is that everybody's metabolism is at a different rate. And if someone's eating a 1,200 calorie a day diet and it's like perfect and they say, I can hardly eat anything, well, that's probably because they're only burning 700 and they just keep gaining weight on 1,200.
Okay. All right, so is there any way then perhaps for those people who probably we're talking about right now to be able to assess their metabolic rate, given that that is what is driving how well they do or don't lose weight?
One way is just to look everything up in a food analysis chart and measure the amount of calories you're eating every day. But another way is to calculate or take note of the fluid that you drink, milk, juice, coffee, total volume of fluid intake in a day, and measure the total volume of urine output in the same period of time. And the difference is what's evaporated.
Okay.
And in an average level of activity and average relative humidity, a person will generally evaporate 1 liter per 1,000 calories burned. So if you have only a missing liter of fluid in the day, you know you're only burning 1,000 calories.
So if someone gets a half a gallon of fluid a day and they only pee out, say, a couple cups,
yeah,
then you know that they're very...
1,500.
Their system is very, very low thyroid. Very high thyroid.
A pint out of 2 liters, that's a 1,500 calorie burning. So that's not very much either.
Right. But if somebody drinks a half a gallon and they practically pee,
A quart and a half, that's a very bad.
A bad ratio.
Yeah.
And a half a gallon, that would be about 2 liters?
Yeah,
there's 4 liters to a gallon.
I just thought we might want to remind listeners that it is 7:30 and the phone lines are open if people want to call in and have any questions about the subject tonight.
Yeah.
Or if any other subject that they're interested in relating
that's right,
to the...
That's right. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Jordan.
Okay, so, excuse me, I know you, you also are very keen that females and males do everything they can to limit their exposure to estrogen for all of its negative effects. Estrogen-dominant females, this is something else that you brought out, that it's not, you don't always take it for granted that estrogen-dominant females would be overweight with those, what we typically imagine as estrogen tendencies, but actually you could get a slender woman based on the same conditions with estrogen.
Yeah. In the animal studies, they've seen that estrogen excites some of the metabolic processes while slowing others down,
okay.
And it can make the animals hyperactive, but very slender. And in people, there are cases where it can do that same thing. It can make a woman tense, very hyperactive and oversensitive and very skinny.
Mm-hmm.
But it can do the other. It can turn on the stress metabolism while it slows the metabolism, lowering the body temperature, for example.
Okay.
And that can lead to excess fat storage.
And that's the same in men as well. Excess estrogen can make some men very thin, and excess estrogen can make some men overweight.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any surefire way of differentiating the one condition in the two separate physical pictures?
No, nothing that I'm sure about.
do you know what the biological preference is for driving it in one or the other direction?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, I had to ask, but I'm sure there's something more that you'll bring out in a bit. We've got two callers on the line, Dr. Pete. So let's take the first of the two callers. You're on the air.
This is David. Hello.
Hi, David.
Where are you calling from tonight, David?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing I want to make bring everyone's attention. Let's find out where everyone is from.
I am from Missouri.
Missouri.
And I've actually talked to Sarah a few times and emailed Dr. Pete. And I really appreciate this show, by the way. I've listened to these podcasts. I've downloaded every podcast that you've done.
You're very welcome.
And that's what I listen to when I drive. And I just...
Great.
Sometimes I've listened to several of these over several times. And
I know there's a lot in there. It takes a while to...
Oh, yeah. No, it's just amazing how it seems like each week that goes by, I just understand this more and more at a deeper level. And I love it.
Yeah, well, iPods are useful then.
absolutely.
And we're very grateful for Dr. Pete.
I've got kind of two different sets of questions that still pertain to everything you talked about tonight. One is I have a fairly weak left knee, and so I've been kind of experimenting with using a rebounder. I've got two different types, a more soft one and then a one that's a little bit firmer, and I kind of go back and forth between the two. I do very light, you know, just bouncing, and then also running in place or jogging, and I usually try to do that, you know, like 3 to 5 minutes. And I do that several times through the day if I'm at home working.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what you think of that.
Dr. Pete?
I don't know if there's much benefit to the bouncing. It does strengthen your bones, I guess, the compression and concussion. But something that builds more massive muscles, stress, even though it isn't fatiguing, just resistance training in little bursts, I think, would help to raise your androgens and strengthen the connective tissues.
And that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, Dr. Pete. So just using, like, different weights and not doing too much stress, but trying to do a certain amount of repetitions where you're just strengthening the muscles, that is a good thing to do.
Make the muscle know that it's been active. Warm it up a little, but not enough to make you get out of breath or anything.
And then what do you feel about just doing basic yoga, you know, like doing different postures and holding those postures where you're actually holding the muscles in a, you know, semi-stressed state, but then relaxing it?
That kind of stress is good for the muscles.
Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, I've been using the 250-watt bulbs that you had recommended, and I've got three of those, and I use those in different places around the house. Because I'm a photographer, I have light stands, so it makes it kind of easy to move them around. But I'm curious, you know, because you've talked about the stress of darkness before after the sun goes down and as you go into the evening before you go to bed, do you think it's useful to use those right before going to bed, like, say, for 15 minutes to a half hour, and then maybe when you arise in the morning, maybe doing it for a half hour, like while you're drinking your coffee, or what do you think of that?
I think so, and I'm basing that on some studies that were done on plant tissues about 30 or 40 years ago. They found that any kind of tissue put in sunlight or ultraviolet light got some excited free radicals or excited electrons, and shining red light on those would just immediately quench those that had been excited. But if you keep living tissue in the dark, it starts building up more of those excited electrons over a period of 30 minutes or so. You can see an increase in them.
So, wow, that's great. Okay. And then just one last question. Is dreaming a sign that you're having a certain degree of stress through the night rather than being in a deep sleep where you're not remembering your dreams when you wake up in the morning or when you wake up in the middle of the night?
Yeah, the metabolism has these cycles. The 24-hour cycle is the basic thing, but it is subdivided into roughly 90-minute cycles of ups and downs where the blood sugar and adrenaline and everything is mobilized a little bit. And if your liver is running short on fuel, the cycles become more intense, and the dream cycles go with drops in the blood sugar and surges of the nerve chemicals such as adrenaline.
Okay.
And so
if you were having a really great dream that was exhilarating and you felt really good about when you woke up, would that still be the case because it's actually causing you to awaken?
Except that's probably that your whole system recognizes that it has been rested and it's time to get up and eat something.
And that's often why you have dreams in the early hours in the morning, because that's when you run out of sugar at that point.
But
that makes sense. I'll be darned. Okay.
What were you going to say, Dr. P?
If your body is well rested from 6 or 8 hours of sleep, then the dreams are likely to have a very pleasant quality, getting you ready to go out and do something.
Yeah, it's preparing you to wake up.
As opposed to the nightmares.
Yeah, as opposed to the 1 a.m. nightmares.
Right, exactly. So that means that your body is really stressed out and it's not getting what it needs.
All right, well, thank you so much for your call.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, we've got two more callers, so let's take the next caller. Hi, and where are you from?
Yeah, I am calling from Piercy.
Oh, okay, just down the road. Okay.
Yeah. I turned the radio on just in the midst of the subject about urinating and taking in fluid. What my question is, if you take in a half gallon of fluid a day and you pee out most of that, is that healthy or is that unhealthy?
It shows that you're not evaporating very much. So in an extremely humid climate, that wouldn't be so bad. But if you're indoors and have a relative humidity of about 50, then it means that your metabolism is slow and not producing much heat.
I see. Okay, so you want a certain amount of evaporation when the atmosphere is, in fact, dry.
Very healthy, like 12 to 15-year-old people burn fuel very wastefully, but that's when people are the least likely to die, is when they're wasting fuel like crazy.
So basically...
When you say least likely to what? To die?
To die, yeah. Around 12 to 15 people are the healthiest and resistant to stress.
So,
right.
Dr. Pete...
That's not based on wasting fuel, though, is it? Or?
It looks like a waste to eat thousands of calories a day when you're not doing anything, but it's good for you.
I see. So a fast metabolism, is that what you're saying, is a healthier metabolism?
Yeah, the wasteful energy metabolism.
Gotcha.
And so,
well,
just to answer another question, caller, if you burn or evaporate half of what you drink, so you pee out the other half, that's pretty much normal in our climate. Wouldn't you agree, Dr. Pete?
If you drink maybe 3 quarts of liquid.
And you pee out a quart and a half.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
That's in this eye case, that would be that's about an average norm.
Right, because we don't have that high humidity like they do in the South.
Okay. Good. So you say that we don't have the high... Oh, okay, gotcha. Especially during the summertime, obviously.
Right.
Even drier.
Dry, yeah.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Real good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for
thank
your call.
Thank you for your call.
All right. Let's take the next call. Hi, hello. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Pete.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading... Oh, this is a fascinating show. Thank you so much.
Where are you from, caller?
I'm Southern Humboldt.
Okay.
I'm reading that one side effect of anti-anxiety and antidepressant drugs is weight gain. Do you know how this works, or do you know how these drugs work at all?
If they increase your exposure to serotonin or decrease your adrenaline, they'll slow your metabolic rate and make it harder to burn calories.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, thank you so much. And you know, just how I'm reading also that they don't really, there's no conclusive studies as to relating a low serotonin level with any mental state. So anyway.
Yeah, they're not even sure how those SSRIs work anyways. Now they're saying that it really doesn't have much to do with serotonin.
Yeah, and they don't have a very good way of describing the topography of the receptors and all of that kind of stuff. So if you can elucidate any on that, I would appreciate it. And I'll just hang up now and listen. Thanks.
Thank you for your call. So, Dr. Pete... I guess the last question was, how are these antidepressants making people feel better if it's not,
if they are,
if it's, it has nothing to do with serotonin increasing or decreasing or anything at all with serotonin?
Oh, they all work in slightly different ways, so you have to think about each one individually. Maybe we should have a special time to go over some of those specific chemicals.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, but thanks for the callers that have been. Okay, so the lines are open from now until 8 o'clock. If you live in the area, the number's 1-800-KMUD-RAD. If you live outside the area, the number's 923... if you live outside the area, the number's 1-800-KMUD-RAD. If you're in the area, it's 923-3911. Okay, so Dr. Pete... Just carrying on with the topic of the ideal diet that I know you've suggested before. which I know Sarah's deals with quite a lot of people with this, and you're mentioning the quart of OJ. Well, do you want to mention the what you would normally be recommending?
Well, if Dr. Pete would recommend something like a quart of orange juice, a quart of milk a day, and you wanted to lose weight, I mean, you wouldn't have much room for anything else if you only burn 700 calories a day.
Well, if you use 1% butterfat milk, that's only 400 calories per quart, where whole milk would be almost twice that much.
Yeah.
And one of the tricks of orange juice is that there are some good chemicals in it which are anti-estrogenic, and some other fruits, tropical fruits, are some of the anti-estrogens are very important for the metabolism, as well as the minerals and type of sugar and such.
So there's compounds you're saying in OJ even?
Yeah.
That are anti-estrogenic?
Yeah, and with milk it isn't just the protein, but the calcium is very important as an anti-inflammatory, anti-stress, antidepressant, and so on. People who eat the same number of calories without milk are much more likely to be fat than the people who are regular milk drinkers.
Hmm. Okay.
I know. Why don't you tell us about your experience when you were in Finland, I think it was, Finland and Russia?
Oh, well, in Russia and the Slavic countries in general, I found that there was really no reliably good milk in the cities. And the people all had bad teeth and were fat. And food was very cheap, but milk was scarce. And probably proteins in general weren't as cheap as the average food. But crossing over the border into Finland, it was very impressive to see how many stores had displays of cheese in the window. Mm-hmm. And the people were all healthy-looking and slender compared to on the other side of the border.
Well, we noticed the same thing in France. You go to France, and everywhere they all eat cheese. And for the most part, they're all very slender.
Yeah, aren't they?
So I guess what you're saying is that 400 calories from orange juice is not comparative to 400 calories from baked potatoes and rice.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
It stimulates your metabolism and suppresses the stress hormones.
Whereas 400 calories from baked potato and rice would increase your stress hormones and suppress your metabolism.
And
yeah, and then there's the matter of the starch particles, that if you don't have some saturated fat with them, the starch particles can set up a whole pattern of stress and injury by entering your bloodstream, which people taking supplements should be very careful to avoid anything with particles such as titanium dioxide or silica.
Those are very allergenic particles that are in all supplements, practically.
Yeah, and those things getting into the bloodstream trigger the stress hormones, and obesity is the least of the things they contribute to.
Okay, we've got a few more callers on the line, Dr. Pete, so let's take this first caller. You're on the air, and where are you from?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Where are you from?
I've been trying to lose some weight, and I've been weighing myself periodically and at nighttime as well in the morning. And it seems to me that I lose about 5 pounds of weight sleeping. Some nights I've noticed I've urinated. Sometimes I haven't urinated. And it seems always about the same, about 5 pounds. And I'm wondering where this 5 pounds goes, if it's with heat, and if there's a relationship between being cold at night and warm at night, whether you lose more weight in cooler climates than you would in warmer, even though warmer climate people seem to be thinner than cooler climate people.
It depends on how you respond to the cold. Some people steam up the windows of the bedroom so the window runs water down and collects at the bottom of the windowsill in the morning. Those are the people who lose a lot of weight by evaporation during the night. You can see the water collecting on the cool surfaces.
And then people in warmer climates are warmer, so their metabolisms stay up during the night, and they probably are thinner because of that, right, Dr. Pete?
Yeah. When your body temperature drops in the night because you're slowing it down to resist the stress, but if you reach a certain temperature, you turn on the inflammatory stress-producing hormones, and so you get not only the darkness but the cold, cold extremities causing stress.
It's better to be comfortable if you're actually trying to shed weight. Is better to be comfortable at night, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's reaching the low temperatures. You mean, Dr. Pete?
Yeah. If your feet reach 90 degrees Fahrenheit. They're producing toxic, stress-inducing substances.
Got it.
So don't run around barefoot with cold feet.
Yeah, we're always telling our nieces that. Always make sure they get their socks on. I know my grandma's always...
That's incredible.
An advocate for keeping your feet warm when you get out of bed. Don't
cold head.
Yeah, well, cold head and cold feet, not good
and,
for you.
Some people taking a warm foot bath at bedtime and then putting on warm socks and a wool cap sleep a lot better.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, we have two more callers, so thanks for your caller.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, next caller, you're on the air?
I'm here.
Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Hi, where are you calling from?
Is that me?
Yes, it's you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Phillipsville,
okay. That's 15 miles up the road. Okay, go ahead.
Well, there's a couple of questions I had. One, I'm curious, in the beginning you said something about eating food that tastes delicious to you was good for you, but you didn't say what foods those were.
It varies with the person, but you should try to avoid the things that affect your metabolism harmfully, like starches and polyunsaturated fats. Some plant materials are toxic, but otherwise, just what appeals.
Is it good to eat whole grains like brown rice and millet?
No, there's almost nothing of value in those.
Even if it's not processed. I don't mean like white rice.
The white rice is relatively free of irritants and toxins, but it has very little of food value in the carbohydrate.
Well, I thought brown rice had a lot of vitamins and fiber and things that were good for you.
Not compared to, like, say, orange juice.
Okay, so, now, when it comes to... Okay, how about ice cream? A good ice cream that doesn't have chemicals in it, like Haagen-Dazs or something. Is that good for you or not? I mean, it's got high calories.
If you're trying to lose weight, then I wouldn't recommend you eat ice cream. But if you're not trying to lose weight, you're happy with your weight, and you're having trouble sleeping, it can help a lot of people... Go to sleep.
Milk and sugar is a bad food combination.
I heard that.
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all, Jordan.
If you had like some cheese or a small glass of milk or something, that there's something in that that helps you sleep.
Milk contains a good balance all in itself because it has some fat, some protein, and some sugar.
Well, I don't drink milk, but I do put half and half in my coffee in the morning. Does that count?
I didn't hear that.
I said I don't usually drink milk by itself, but I put half and half in my coffee in the morning. Does that count?
No, that's mostly cream.
Well, and that's not good? I mean, it's half cream, half milk, I guess.
Well, it's okay if it goes with other food, such as protein and sugars.
Now, you mentioned orange juice a lot, but what are the other fruit juices? I tend to really enjoy other fruit juices like berry juice and peach juice and carrot juice and cherry juice and all kinds of different juices. you know, that don't have sugar in them, and I tend to drink them like half diluted with water, so they're not so strong. But I've had people tell me that it's not good for me because it has too much sugar in it and too many calories. So what do you think about juices other than orange juice?
Many juices are good. It's the minerals and antioxidants as well as the sugar that are important. But grapefruit juice, for example, has a chemical that causes your liver to increase estrogen in the body.
Oh, no, I don't mean grapefruit juice. I'm thinking of, you know, like apricot juice, peach juice, berry juice, grape juice, those kinds.
Grape juice is very good as long as you consider the calories. It has more concentrated calories than orange juice. Some tropical fruits are very good. Guava, for example.
Uh-huh. Mango.
Carrot juice is another one that should be avoided except in small amounts because of the high carotene content.
It's very metabolically suppressive.
Oh, it is.
It antagonizes both thyroid and progesterone.
What's good for thyroid? You know, what's good for, like, stimulating your metabolism so that you burn calories quicker, but, you know, you won't have an overactive thyroid?
Milk, cheese, and some of the fruit juices are the best things.
Right, so 400 calories from fruit juice isn't going to be the same as eating 400 calories of brown rice. The 400 calories of brown rice is going to be much more metabolically suppressive than the 400 calories from fruit juice.
Really?
Yeah, I'm thank you for your call, but it is a couple of minutes to the top of the hour, and I want to make sure that the listeners who are tuned in get to know Dr. Raymond Pete's contact details. So, unfortunately, we've come to the end of this show, Dr. Pete. Thanks so much for your input and your wisdom.
And I'm sorry we couldn't get to you other callers.
I'm sorry that we had two more callers on the line, but I'm afraid we couldn't get to you.
Join us next month, March 15th.
So those people that have listened to us, and Dr. Raymond Pete most especially, his contact details are www.raypete.com, full of what we would call scientific articles, folks, so not just hearsay, not just things that he's come up with, but a lot of his articles are fully referenced, so there's plenty of science behind it.
And that's raypete.com.
Okay, so lots of articles there for people to read, and even the subject we've mentioned this evening, there's plenty of information there. So thanks again for all the callers, and we can also be reached toll-free Monday through Friday, 1-888-WBM-HERB. So until the third Friday of next month,
which is March 15th.
Yep, we look forward to speaking with Dr. Pete again and with those people who've tuned in. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for your callers.
One month from today, we'll be back again with the Herb Doctor, the Herb Doctors. Thank them so much for a great informative program. Really glad to be here engineering tonight. Usually I'm enjoying that program from home. Support for KMID comes in part from Golden Dragon Medicinal Syrup, an anti-inflammatory, antifungal, antibacterial, antioxidant medicine made without heat or ice. Golden Dragon Medicinal Syrup is organic, edible, topical, cosmetic, and water-soluble. Information is available at goldendragonmedicinalsyrup@gmail.com and by phone at 707-223-1569. And to date, none of the positive attributes of Golden Dragon Medicinal Syrup have yet to be exaggerated. Stay tuned. Funked Up with Cousin Mark is next.
It is 8 o'clock and 53 degrees here in Redway, home of the greatest radio station on the planet. This one right here, Redwood Community Radio. KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. KMUE Eureka Arcata, 88.1 FM. KLAI Laytonville, 90.3.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of Redwood Community Radio. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of KMUD or renewing if you've already joined. A regular yearly membership is $50, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.